Let me ask a question before we begin this morning. How many of you have seen the movie, it's been out maybe a little over a decade now, but Batman Begins? We've seen the movie Batman Begins. Great flick. The first of the trilogy by Christopher Nolan, I think it is. Interpretation of Batman's origins and all that. But great movie. Well, there's a line, there's a scene in the movie, if you remember, if you've seen it, where Bruce Wayne, played by Christian Bale, great actor, he is kind of this billionaire, playboy type of partier, and he's at a party, and he's got this beautiful woman on each arm, and they end up like in this fountain, and he has this conversation with a childhood friend and this woman that he cares about a lot by the name of Rachel Dawes, who's played by Katie Holmes. And he's trying to explain to her that, you know, what she sees with how he's acting, it's not who he really is. It's not what's underneath. And she makes this statement to him that kind of hit me when I caught this on TV a few weeks ago, the end of it. She says to Bruce, "It's not who you are underneath. It's what you do that defines you. It's not who you are underneath. It's what you do that defines you." Is that true? Is that true? It rings true, but then it doesn't. And Rachel's statement that she makes to Bruce Wayne, it actually highlights an essential issue for us as followers of Jesus, an important issue about what it means to have priorities. What is the relationship between doing on the one hand and being? Between doing and being. What's the relationship between work and worship? What's the relationship between our character and our actions? And that's what we're talking about today. The title of the message today is called The One Thing. And we're talking about the top priority that should order all other areas and all other activities in the lives of those who follow Jesus. If you're a follower of Jesus, there is a one thing, a top priority. And Jesus makes that clear to us today in Luke chapter 10. So go ahead and turn there in your Bibles. We also have Bibles in the back corner. If you don't have one with you, that's okay. And if you don't own a Bible or you need one, take one of those and keep it. Take it with you. Those are there for you. So Luke chapter 10 in the New Testament. And we're jumping back into, after a breakthrough this fall in the first part of the winter here, to a sermon series that we spent a lot of 2013 on in the Gospel of Luke, talking about who is Jesus? Who is Jesus? What does he say about who he is? What do his actions declare about who he is? What did people say about him that shows us who he is? What did God the Father say about who Jesus is? Who is Jesus? And along with that, what does he want from us? In light of who he is, how are we to respond to him? And what does life as a follower of him look like? That's where we've been in the Gospel of Luke, not recently, but over the past year. Now, in Luke chapter 10, verses 38 through 42, Jesus' meal with two sisters, it creates an opportunity to teach about the priorities in a disciple's life. Let's look at Luke chapter 10, short passage this morning, verses 38 through 42. I'll read that for us. Starting in verse 38, it says, "Now as they went on their way, Jesus entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving. And she went up to him and said, 'Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me.' But the Lord answered her, 'Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her.'" Now, where we're going this morning is in this short passage that Luke gives us in his gospel between this Jesus and these two sisters, Martha and Mary. We're going to unpack three short scenes that occur in this account and then make some applications about what this has to do with our lives and the very relevant implications that Jesus has for us today as followers of him. Let's look first at the setting. A meal at Martha's place, at her house. Jesus is traveling, we're told, with his disciples, because the account begins by saying, as they went on their way, as they went on their way. Luke reminds us that Jesus and his disciples, the 12, and maybe even more than that, others that were following along with them perhaps, they're on a journey, they're on a way, they're on a path. And where Jesus is heading is to Jerusalem. We know that from back in chapter 9, verse 51, where there's a major transition in Luke's gospel. Because up until that time, Jesus had begun his public ministry in the northern region of Galilee. He'd been healing, he'd been preaching, he'd been teaching, he'd been casting out demons, doing all kinds of amazing things. And in chapter 9, verse 51, there's a shift because Jesus starts heading south to Jerusalem. So we're in this progression, this journey, all the way from chapter 9 through several chapters, all the way up to, I believe it's chapter 18 or so, where Jesus arrives in Jerusalem, the place where he will be crucified, the place of his death. And that journey gives an opportunity to teach about that road of discipleship in our lives, the road of following him. Through various narratives in this section, this immediate section, chapter 9, verse 1 through 11, verse 13, Luke describes what's involved in following Jesus in this journey of discipleship. So Jesus enters a certain village as they're on their way, as they're on this journey. From John's gospel, we know that, Luke doesn't tell us, but we know that the village is Bethany on the outskirts of Jerusalem. One of the reasons Luke doesn't tell us the name of the village is probably because everything that he gives us here is not always arranged chronologically. That's not how the gospels work. Sometimes they put things together topically, and Luke puts this account here for us to see something that fits into his overall message about discipleship in this case. So we're introduced right away to Jesus entering this village and three characters in the story. Jesus, of course, who's the main character, but then Martha and Mary, two sisters. Now, look side by side at the actions of these two sisters, which Luke wants us to see clearly. We have Martha and Mary. First, Martha, she welcomes Jesus into her home, into her house. She's distracted with much serving, verse 40. She's working to serve and to minister to Jesus. She wants to lavish him with hospitality, to put on a spread for him. And it's probably a large meal. Probably not a large house, but a large meal. Jesus, his disciples, maybe others. This is a big production. This is a big feeding. And she went up to Jesus, verse 40, approaches him. She asks a question, makes a request of Jesus, verse 40. And verse 41 also tells us, though, Jesus says, for Martha, she's anxious and she's troubled about many things. Now, Mary, on the other hand, Luke wants us to also see her example. She sat at the Lord's feet, verse 39. It's often the way of describing a disciple, and Luke uses that language to describe disciples of Jesus in his gospel. A little earlier in his gospel, Jesus had healed this man that was possessed by several multitude of demons. And the what you find is after he's healed, after he's in his right mind, he's what? Sitting at the feet of Jesus, listening to his words, sitting at Jesus' feet, the posture of a disciple. Mary's assuming this posture or this place of a disciple. She's listening to the Lord's teaching, verse 39. And Jesus says of Mary, the other sister, that she has chosen the good portion or the good part or the better part. So both Mary and Martha in this text, they have an idea of what it means to be a disciple, what it means to be a follower of Jesus. The difference is that at least on this occasion, this occurrence, they have very different priorities. Very different priorities. Look next at what happens. Scene 2, Martha's speech. Just the first part of verse 40 here. Or actually the second part, rather. Look at what she says again. She went up to him, went up to Jesus, that is, and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me. She appears to be quite frustrated by the situation, especially by her sister's actions. There were things to be done, right? There were things to be prepared. This is no small group that need fed. There's a lot to do. And she wants Mary, literally at this point, to get off her butt and to help. Mary was also confusing the normal, traditional, cultural place or role of a woman in this circumstance. It was kind of radical, very radical, in fact, for a woman to take this posture of a learner, a disciple of a teacher or a rabbi sitting at their feet, assuming that what goes along with that is learning and teaching. So it's radical. Maybe part of Martha's frustration, we don't know for sure, but it could be the fact that Mary's role should really be in the kitchen, in her mind, and not sitting at the feet of Jesus. Well, whatever is going on in her head, which we can't get into at this point, she's frustrated. And before we're too hard on Martha, though, which it's easy to do, is let's put ourselves in her shoes. Put yourself in her shoes. Jesus is at your house. Jesus is at your house. Now, how many of you, when you have people coming over to your place, whether it's an apartment, condo, home, whatever it is, get a little frazzled and want to pick things up a little bit and get out the vacuum and start going nuts and trip over the coffee table? You can ask my wife and my kids. Sometimes I'm running around like a chicken with my head cut off sometimes and anxious and frazzled and just like Martha here. Now imagine it's on a bigger scale. You're hosting at your place a Christmas gathering with extended family, a large group of people. Probably a close analogy to what's going on here. A large group of people, a large meal, a lot to be done, a lot of preparations to be made, a lot of serving to happen. Now, Martha, there's other places where we see Martha, like John's gospel. She is a woman of deep faith. She has a conversation with Jesus in John 11 that's just amazing about resurrection and her faith in him and her belief in him as the Christ. But in this instance, it's interesting how Martha responds to Jesus in verse 40. First, she asks the Lord a question, which is really an accusation. Don't you care, Jesus? You're acting like you don't care. Then she makes, it's a nice word to say a request. It's really a demand. Tell her to help me. Tell her, my sister, to do something. Now think about our lives. When we're distracted, when we're overburdened and anxiously busy, we tend also to have a distorted view of reality, don't we? We start to think, like Martha, no one understands our situation. No one understands how hard we're working. No one really knows the stress we're under. No one appreciates what we do. We view ourselves as the martyr who deserves more. And like Martha, we begin and we cross the line of actually making demands of God because he doesn't understand either with all the things to do and how hard we're working. So between Mary and Martha here, who do you tend to identify more with? Who do you tend to identify with? If I'm honest in my life, it's Martha. I identify with her. I fall into the same trap that she did here many, many times. And maybe you do too. Look at how Jesus responds to her, verses 41 through 42. He says, Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her. He doesn't take Martha's side, which had to leave her astounded and standing there shocked with her mouth gaping open, that Jesus didn't see her perspective, see it her way. Jesus tells Martha she's anxious, she's troubled, she's upset about many things. But the heart of the passage is in verse 42, where Jesus makes this statement, this teaching, which has to do especially in Luke's bigger picture of including this account at this place, has to do with discipleship. Jesus says, one thing, Martha, one thing is necessary. Jesus turns the discussion, turns Martha's questions and demands, requests, he turns it into a discussion about priorities. Actually, the priority, the most important priority. Then he affirms Mary's action. He says, Mary has chosen the good portion. The ESV Study Bible points out in one of the notes, it says that this Jesus using this phrase, the good portion, it echoes what we see a lot in the Old Testament about the greatest possession being close fellowship with the Lord. The portion in this life, God is our portion. Now, it's important to remember that we're seeing one moment in the life of Martha and her sister Mary here. This incident, it may not characterize the pattern of their overall lives, but Luke uses this snapshot, this picture, this circumstance. He uses it to teach the readers of his gospel and to show us a lesson about following Jesus as a disciple. In the story, Martha is more consumed and worried and anxious about the duties, about the tasks that need to be done for Jesus, when she should have been focusing about, according to Jesus, communing with him, listening to him. If Martha doesn't, and if we don't, make communion with Jesus, meeting with Jesus, listening to Jesus, being with Jesus, if we don't make that one thing a priority, what happens is everything else in our lives that we try to order out of whack will become like a spinning plate that begins wobbling and then crashes to the floor if we don't get this one thing right. So what are some ways that Luke 10, 38 through 42, this short section, what are some ways this is relevant? Well, we already looked at this a little bit, but let's ask ourselves, what's the point? What's the point of Luke's narrative here? First, the point is not a comparison between a contemplative life and an active life. It's not comparing those types of lives. It isn't to pit the contemplative person against the active person, like the life of a monk in solitude is more faithful to God than a social worker that's out there in the dirt getting things done. That's not the point of what Luke is setting up here and what Jesus is saying. Now, the point is also not to make a case for the empowerment of women, which, interestingly enough, half of the commentators out there grab as the main point of this whole section. Now, having said that, however, the place of women as learners and disciples of Jesus, it's elevated here. And this is radical in Jesus' day to show that Mary, as a female disciple, she is living out a radical portrayal, an example, and role of what it means to be a learner of Jesus. No, the place of women isn't just in the kitchen with Martha. They are indispensable to the mission, to the kingdom, as disciples, men and women, involved in advancing the cause of Christ. One writer says it this way, in contrast to common rabbinic practice, and what that means is the practice of Jewish religious teachers and leaders of the day, Jesus encouraged women to listen to his teaching and to become part of his ministry. So what's the point? Well, Luke is saying to us that the highest priority in the life of a disciple, whether man or woman, as a disciple, man, woman, child, should be to listen to the words of Jesus. Listen to the words of Jesus. Know him. Hear him. Worship him. Be with him. Now, there's a lifelong tension between serving Jesus and sitting at his feet, isn't there? Tension between serving and sitting. Do you feel it? If we don't prioritize worshiping Jesus over working for Jesus, though, we'll never worship through our work. ministry for Jesus must flow out of meeting with Jesus. We can become so consumed with taking action that we neglect the one thing, adoration of Jesus. Focusing on him, being with him. The examples of Martha and Mary in the story, they involve and relate to these realities of doing and being. Doing and being. Regarding doing, maybe you're here today and the pattern of your life is that you're trying to gain acceptance before God through doing, through what you do, through living a good life, through serving God a lot and more than the next person, according to your perspective. But the good news of the gospel, thankfully, is that the gospel, it means an end to trying to work your way to a better life. We cannot work our way to a better life because there's a problem deep within our heart, our sinful hearts of rebellion against our Creator that us working harder won't fix. And becoming a Christian, becoming a follower of Jesus, according to the Bible, it begins with trusting in Jesus and trusting in what? Not our work, but his saving work on our behalf. Because he worked, and in his life, his death on the cross, his resurrection, in our place, by believing in him, we don't have to work to gain acceptance. But in believing in him, in humbling ourselves before him, in embracing Jesus as our Savior, as Midge shared about, that pivotal point in her life, in doing that, then our lives begin to be transformed by his grace. And guess what? He works out our salvation and his mission through us. So he produces good works in our life, but we don't go about working in order to gain acceptance. Now, what about the relationship between doing and being, though? Is doing an important part of discipleship? Is doing an important part of following Jesus? Absolutely. Absolutely. The passage just before this was about the Good Samaritan, where Jesus makes the point that what it means to be to love your neighbor is to ask the question every day, who can I be a neighbor to? Who can I show mercy to? Who can I show the love of God to? And actually, what you need to do is do that for people that you don't want to and that are unlike you and the hard to love. Jesus has just said that. Discipleship is about putting your money where your mouth is. Isn't that one of the biggest accusations leveled at Christians? That they don't put their money where their life is? Or their money where their mouth is, rather? That they say a lot of good things and may believe things, but what a bunch of hypocrites, right? What a bunch of non-doers. Or James. In the New Testament, the letter that James writes, he talks about how faith without works is dead. A faith that doesn't result in doing good things and good works is actually a dead faith. So yes, doing is important. But what about being? Is that an important part of discipleship? Absolutely. It's not an either-or issue. John 15, Jesus talks about the importance of abiding in me. Being in me, abiding in my love, through prayer, through listening to me, through spending time with me. It's language of a relationship with him. That's what the Christian life is all about. That's what following Jesus is all about. The problem arises between doing and being when a good thing like service takes the place of a greater thing like sitting at Jesus' feet in worship. Being has to be prioritized over doing. That's the point. Being has to be elevated over doing so that doing can be done worshipfully. So in Luke 10, 38 through 42, being with Jesus involves listening to his word. Listening to his word. Listening to the teaching of Jesus. It's the most important component of discipleship because it determines how one should serve. This is one of the reasons why, just as a side note, I'm excited about the men's Bible reading group that we've started. Because what better place to start to raise up men who love Jesus and live as men of God than to listen to Jesus by getting into his word on a regular basis? It could be revolutionary, the transformation that happens and the effect from that, which he calls all of us to. Now, as I was preparing for this message this week, it was interesting. I looked at some old notes because I preached this same passage 12 years ago at the end of December, kind of looking ahead to 2003. And my life has gotten, it seems, a lot more complex since then. And I would like to think that I have a more tested perspective on distractions and busyness. And the only reason for that is because I've had more time to mess up and do the wrong things. But on the one hand, the goal in our lives regarding distractions and busyness from the one thing, the goal isn't to eliminate all distractions in our lives. And back then, I might have said that or thought that that was possible. Actually, that's not possible. It's not possible to eliminate all distractions from our lives. In fact, some things that we call distractions may actually be divine appointments that God uses in our lives and in the lives of others. Now, on the other hand, there are some distractions, okay, that we unnecessarily create for ourselves. Distractions that don't have to be there, but that we create. In one of the assignments I had to do for a class recently, it was on time management. And this is one of the things I noticed about my life. That distractions are inevitable. And you have to learn in your life how to deal with those and approach those and so forth. But a lot of them we create ourselves. Here's one example that'll hit really close to home in my life and probably in many of our lives. Social media. Social media. Yeah, let's talk about that. In preparing for this sermon this week, I read this really short book. It'll take you an hour and a half. Maybe if you're a fast reader, less. Called Crazy Busy by Kevin DeYoung. Great author. He's a pastor in East Lansing, Michigan. Does a lot of blogging and writing and speaking for Gospel Coalition, things like that. But he has a chapter in here. It's about unhealthy busyness. And chapter 7, it's called Deep Calls to Deep. And it says, the subtitle of the chapter, "You Are Letting the Screen Strangle Your Soul." It's like, whoa. But what he says in here is that, on the one hand, new technology, social media, all the screens that we have in our lives, it has created new capabilities, new opportunities for the gospel, good things. But on the other hand, just like any technology, it has created new dangers as well. And he asks this question: What are the threats that our screens in our lives pose to our souls and our sanity? Okay, what are the threats of the screens in our lives? Three he lists. First, the threat of addiction. Some of us, and this may be you, are likely addicted to our screen, our computers, our phones, our iPad, whatever it is, television, addiction. Threat number two, it's the threat of acedia, which he defines as, and this is good, purposelessness disguised as constant commotion. We're all doing a lot of stuff. We're crazy busy, right? Just the thumb is, you've got like a thumb cramp or thumb tendonitis from scrolling down and refreshing your phone, right? A lot of commotion, but not a lot actually getting done and being zoned out and just purposelessness in the midst of a lot of activity. That's a danger. And then the third danger, very interesting, he says, the danger that we are never alone. We're never alone. And he, along those lines of never being alone, he quotes a guy by the name of Peter Kreeft. Listen to this. Peter Kreeft says, we want to complexify our lives. We don't have to. We want to. We want to be harried and hassled and busy. Unconsciously, we want the very things we complain about. For if we had leisure, we would look at ourselves and listen to our hearts and see the great gaping hole in our hearts and be terrified, because that hole is so big that nothing but God can fill it. I read that and I wrote, like, convicting. Horribly convicting. All this busyness, all this activity, like Martha, anxious, distracted, worried, serving, doing all kinds of stuff. Some things that we create ourselves unnecessarily, unhealthily. And we do that because the silence is far too scary, because it reveals really that we don't want to listen to Jesus. We don't want to commune with Jesus, and it's uncomfortable. And we run out of things to say after about 5 seconds. Now, fortunately, DeYoung goes on to outline several suggestions on navigating a life lived in the digital age and screen world. He talks about having a healthy suspicion towards technology. He talks about be more thoughtful and understanding in your connectedness with others. Deliberately using old technology, like write a letter with a pen. And then making boundaries, fighting with all your might to protect those. And then bringing your Christian theology to bear on these dangers. And this is from a guy who is, like, really into social media stuff, right? Writing to himself and me speaking this to myself. Most of us, myself included, probably need to implement some type of a Sabbath from our electronic devices. That's just reality. To take some type of a break where you put them away and don't look at them. At least, maybe your job during the day is to look at a screen, to look at a computer. But you put away the social media for a few hours, a day, a week. Take a Sabbath and detox a little bit and realize how consuming and how distracting these have actually been. Let me close with a couple questions as we think about this priority, this one thing of listening at the feet of Jesus. First, what is currently distracting you from being with Jesus, from listening to his word? What's currently distracting you from being with Jesus? Maybe it's social media. Maybe it's something else. Second, what steps are you going to take? What steps will we take to resist unhealthy busyness and distractions that threaten our priority of communing with Jesus? What steps will we take to resist the unhealthy busyness in our lives and actually make listening to Jesus through his word, through prayer, a priority that orders and sets all the other priorities in our lives? I'm going to end with reading Psalm 16 just as a prayer for us. And the overlap with Luke 10, 38 through 42, just happened to be reading Psalm 16 this week, and I was struck by the parallels, and maybe even wondering if Jesus had this psalm in mind when he was talking to Martha. So let's listen to this together as a prayer. David writes, "Preserve me, O God, for in you I take refuge. I say to the Lord, you are my Lord. I have no good apart from you. As for the saints in the land, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. The sorrows of those who run after another God shall multiply. Their drink offerings of blood I will not pour out or take their names on my lips. The Lord is my chosen portion and my cup. You hold my lot. The lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Indeed, I have a beautiful inheritance. I will bless the Lord who gives me counsel. In the night also, my heart instructs me. I have set the Lord always before me, because he is at my right hand. I shall not be shaken. Therefore, my heart is glad and my whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence, there is fullness of joy, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Lord, help us to be able to hear from you. Help us to make the one thing, the priority that you give us as your followers, to be, to sit at your feet, to listen to you, to listen to your word, and may that priority shape everything else in our lives. Lord, it's not about trying harder in our own strength. It's about how much we are in need of you to enable us to grow in this area. So Lord, by your grace, would you do that? Would you reveal what distractions need to be dealt with in order to hear from you, to commune with you, that all of life might flow out of that for us as disciples? In Jesus' name, we pray. Amen.